Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody here with us again this week. We've got a great show coming up for you. In fact, a returning guest that we're really excited about having on the show. Before we get to him, though, I do want to welcome my co-host back. It's great to have you here, Sam Bradley. Thank you so much. You're in the process of helping me edit my book, and so I'm sorry I've been taking you away from other chores.
Well, it is a choice, Jamie. And yes, we're not going to give it away, but you people have a good treat coming your way. Jamie's written a novel, and it's awesome. It's so much fun. We're having a great time. In fact, we've been having a great time for about almost an hour sitting here chatting with Dr. Joe and our guest, Dr. Dan Diamond, to the extent that we've kind of forgot we were doing a podcast. So we'll catch you up on some of that. But hi, Joe.
Hi, Sam. Hi, guys.
How you doing?
Good to be back again. Doing well.
And Dr. Dan, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks a bunch. I'm glad to be back. We had so much fun last time. I'm looking forward to chatting with you again today.
So before we get into our little news item segment, just to refresh everybody's memory a little bit about your background for those that maybe didn't catch the previous episode.
I'm an old guy, so I've been doing this for a long time. I ran the medical triage unit at the New Orleans Convention Center after Katrina, and I led first teams into Haiti and the Philippines and Honduras, Mexico, and I've been to Africa and India and Thailand, and I've been all over the place doing medicine.
Fantastic. Well, welcome back. It's great to have you back with us, Dan, and we'll talk with you about some of your other exploits as we continue on that theme. But I wanted to bring up a topic, Sam, that we had I sent an email to you about it's actually the anniversary of the London bombing back in 2005, 10 years ago on July 7th, when we're recording this. We record this a couple weeks ahead of time, remember. But on July 7th, 2005, they had the London tube bombings where their subway system and other public transport systems were bombed by a couple of suicide bombers. And so it was talking about the aftermath and people recalling that. And it's kind of a similar event maybe in some ways to 9/11. Would you agree maybe, Sam?
I would, especially since this was an act of terrorism. And EMS World did a great job of putting up an article that was actually by some of the survivors and how they felt at the time and how they feel now. And, it always grabs you when it's a first-person kind of thing like that. And I think it's good that we're talking about this because we need to honor these kinds of things that occur in other countries as they honored us when 9/11 occurred. Would you agree, Joe?
Oh, I would completely, yeah. This was, I think, very similar to 9/11 for them. This was the worst terrorist attack on British soil with 52 people killed. I think could certainly hand it to our colleagues across the pond on their openness in their review and after action reports. I've heard several of those, and they were extremely well done with lots of great lessons learned.
Absolutely. I think we can, regardless of where these events occur in the world, we can learn by each and every one of them. And Dan, as many different things as you've been through, I imagine that's the case with you. You've probably looked at a lot of these after action reports, huh?
Yeah. And you know, the other thing that happens on a personal level that's really moving is when the EMS people from one disaster show up at another disaster. And we saw that in Katrina. So after 9/11, the guys from New York came and they were there helping the people from New Orleans with the sense of we want to give back. But just meeting them was so emotional. I mean, for all of us to see them rallying and giving back and being there because they knew what it was like to be in the midst of a really horrible disaster. And so they were able to identify with the local EMS people and encourage them on a completely different plane than those of us that are always responding but have never been through the initial event.
Oh, that's so true. I remember it was you that told us about it. I just got chills when you said that because I thought that was so awesome. And, you know, it tells you something about New Yorkers. You know, they're always willing to give back because many people gave to them.
One firefighter that when he wasn't working, he was building or redoing roofs for people in New York. That was his job. And he brought all of his roofing tools and everything with him and let it be known that if there were any of the workers, the disaster workers that had their buildings, their homes ruined, that he'd go out and redo the roof for them.
Yeah, that is so awesome.
You know, so we had a guy, one of the docs came to me and said, hey, you know, I would love to come and help you, but I got to spend the next couple of days to get my roof patched. I said, oh, no, you don't. I got the phone number of a guy from New York that's here specifically because he wants to fix your roof.
You probably thought you were crazy when you said that. I mean, that's like, that is way too good to be true. That is unrealistic.
That was awesome.
That is so cool.
It was in my yellow pages. Did I tell you about the yellow pages when we talked last month?
I don't think so.
This is a smart thing to do, and I would encourage anybody that's in a disaster to do this, is to take a notebook with you. And I found a notebook there in the abandoned warehouse that we were in, and I started keeping the yellow pages. So every time I met somebody, I wrote down their name, their phone number, and what they could do to help. And pretty soon I had 5 pages in my book of people and all the different things that they could do. So I became known as the guy with the yellow pages because it was yellow book. And they would call me. So, you know, the guys at the airport would call over and they'd say, hey, who do you know that can do this? I'd look at my book and say, yeah, have this guy do it. But it became such a great resource because you never know what's going to come up because we're improvising all the time. And there were so many people that came and went through the triage area because we were the only level one triage area for the whole city. So we saw all the city officials, and I had the cell phone number for the mayor and the mayor's assistant, and you know, all those sorts of things were in my yellow pages. And then all the people that came from around the world to help, I had down what they could do and what their resources were.
What an awesome idea.
This sounds like another thing to add to your bag of tricks for the USAR team.
Oh, I do exactly the same thing. You know, we actually have an official form that we use that helps us to gather those resources, whether they're medical or sort of otherwise. So we've formalized that process a little bit. But Dan's right. You run into so many people that can do so many things, and some of them you don't even know where they fit. But it's a phenomenal resource.
Yeah, and it becomes evident maybe 3 or 4 days later where they fit.
Exactly.
And there's nothing worse than, oh, man, I met a guy that did, but I don't know how to get a hold of him.
Right.
Feeling. So I just wrote down everybody's contact info. And the cells are up and running in no time. They bring in the cows, the cells on wheels, and life is good.
We just need to find out if you're there. Hey, if Dan's there, just call him. He's got everything.
Well, you know, next time we do this, we should. I came back from that experience with this idea of doing a GASP analysis. So GASP stands for Get a Spherical Perspective. And if you look at it from how can I impact my sphere of influence, when you go into a disaster, it changes everything. If you look at it from, you know, the business world, they talk about doing a GAP analysis. And that was, you'd start at point A and you're trying to get to point B and you try to figure out how creatively you're going to move from point A to point B. And that's dangerous in a disaster. That can get you killed. You know, if you think about a truck that's on fire or a car that's on fire and we stop by and it's been an accident with a truck and we go over there and we're trying to get the fire out. Point A, the car is on fire. Point B, you're trying to get the fire out. Very simple GAP analysis. How do you bridge the gap? Oh, I got a fire extinguisher in my car. We're putting out the fire. And then all of a sudden we hear a funny noise right before the propane truck that ran into the guy blows up. And we didn't see it because we were so focused on the fire on the car. So, I mean, fire guys get this big time. You guys are, I've learned this from, you know, Paul Wright, my buddy that's a battalion chief, said, you know, you got to have somebody that's looking around and moving around in 360s all the time, making sure you're not going to get hit from something from behind. And that safety officer role is so important. Well, the business world finally caught up and they said, well, we should do a SWOT analysis. You know, so then we're doing strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. So I think about it a little bit differently. The GAP analysis is a one dimension. It's just a line. The SWOT analysis is a 360. That's a two-dimensional deal. I think about it from a three-dimensional sphere that's made up of a bunch of slices. So maybe the EMS is one slice, and then the private ambulance companies might be another slice, and then The mayor's office might be another slice, and the docs coming from the hospitals, the local guys might be a slice. And each one of those slices has their own A and B, what they're trying to do. They have their own strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. But if I pay attention and I ask the right questions, I can find out what each of those levels, where their pain point is, and what resources they have and what they're really doing well. And then I can match those up, and I become the conduit for those different slices. And so then I can say to the guy that has a hole in his roof, no, man, there's this other guy from the fire department in New York that fixes roofs. Let me introduce you. Here's his phone number. Boom, I become a conduit. If I'm only focusing on my slice, all I'm thinking about is, how do I get people through my area? How do I do it safely? You know, how do I, you know, where are my resources, my supply line, all that kind of stuff? That then you miss the opportunity to have a huge impact by impacting the whole sphere. So when we go to the cluster meetings for the United Nations at big disasters, there's a lot of swapping of information that goes on around there. But one of the questions that I ask when I meet people is, what's keeping you up at night? That's a great question. And then I ask them, so what are you doing well? Then I know what their resources are, and I know where their pain point is. You know, when we were out at the in Haiti, the Air Force, I said, well, so what's keeping you up at night? And they said, well, you know, we're out here at the airport, and we don't have any place to put body parts, and we're doing all these amputations. I said, oh, piece of cake, I'll take them. And the guy's like, what?
What?
I'll take them, no problem. He said, well, what are you going to do with them? I said, I'm working at a hospital with a bunch of orthopedic surgeons, and we have a burn pit. No way. Yeah, I'm happy to do that for you. Well, what can we do to help you? So this, if you look at it from a sphere perspective, instead of always thinking on your own plane, and you don't care, and this is a key thing, you don't care who gets the credit. You just want to impact the sphere and make it better. Then you can really get stuff done in a disaster.
So you're saying this fire guy from New York is what kind of launched this whole idea? Is you kind of took that perspective of one helping the other and
yeah,
you know, having resources that will take care of this, that, or the other thing and kind of built it into this concept. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's changed my perspective. Changed my perspective at work. You know what I did? One of the first things I did is I went downstairs and talked to my lab and said, hey, is there anything different I can do to make your job easier? And, you know, it was as if they didn't need to think about it. Like maybe they'd been already been talking about it behind my back or something. I don't know. But yeah, they had some suggestions for me. And when I implemented the suggestions, then it didn't take long before those guys were coming upstairs and saying, is there anything we can do differently to make your life better? You know, and you think about, over and over again, I mean, 1,000 times I've thought about the fact that one of the places where the levees tended to fail in New Orleans was the junction between two different jurisdictions. And why does that happen? You know, it's the, well, that's not my job, that's their job. That doesn't work. What happens if you have the attitude of, you know, if you're an EMS and you're saying, our goal with our EMS squad here, with our team is, we want to make the cops look like heroes. You know, everybody's had, so many people are putting the cops down lately. What could we do to make them look good? I mean, not just say thanks, great job, appreciate you being there for us and protecting us and all that stuff, because that's understood. But what could we do to make them look good to the public? That's, you know, those are opportunities that are missed right now. You know, if you're interviewed in the media and the media is saying, gosh, you guys did a great job. What a super opportunity to say, one of the reasons we're able to do the work we do is the police are giving us the necessary support. You wouldn't believe the support that these guys have. They're awesome. You know, so you start looking for those jurisdiction junctions and strengthening them.
Yeah, and they could use something nice said about them these days. There's so much going the other direction. But, you know, you made another point too, Dan, and I think Joe would agree with this, that whatever we're doing, whether it's pre-hospital everyday EMS or USAR or DMAT, we do tend to get narrow focused on our specific task. And I can't tell you how many times we've been on an MVA and there's so much going on around you. But if you ask them, you know, they ask later, well, did you see this? Did you see this? It's like, no, I saw my patient and what I had to do. And your point is so well taken. Somebody, and like you said, the safety officer is probably the best choice, needs to be looking at that big picture and seeing what else is out there that could be a hazard or a problem.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's lots of studies out there showing about tunnel vision and tunnel hearing. And, you know, and it really becomes a problem. I think it's even more of a vivid problem for law enforcement, because when they get tunnel hearing, then they can't hear anybody say anything, and they can't see with tunnel vision. They can only see what they think is a weapon, or if it is a weapon, that's all they can see. They can't see the other stuff going around. And when you go back and view them later, they're blind and deaf when it comes to the other things that are happening. And that's a tough thing.
Well, and I, you know, I almost am not here because my first accident scene as an EMT, I nearly walked around the back of a fire truck into an open lane of traffic.
Yeah.
And somebody literally grabbed me by the back of my turnout coat and yanked me backwards. And then a car went by. And I never forgot that.
Wow.
You know, it was literally that fire officer that was running that came in with that rescue unit that grabbed my and said, pay attention where you are. Always look before you go into a new lane of traffic.
I hope you bought him dinner or something.
Yeah, well, he's a good friend of mine.
I hope so.
Volunteer fire department, so yeah. We all know each other and we watch each other's backs. But that was a lesson that I learned the easy way, so to speak.
Well, I think Dan has very elegantly said two things that I think are sort of core truths for disaster response, and that is situational awareness and resource management at a very large level. You know, a lot of what we do there as first responders and as disaster responders is we're interested in taking care of that individual patient and taking care of whatever task the task force has been assigned to. We're going to search this building or whatever, but you know, I think the impact that you have is multiplied when you're very attuned to the situation and what's going on around you, and you're doing exactly as Dan talked about earlier, and that is looking for those opportunities of where can I take in information and then use that to have an impact someplace else. And really it's just matching up the services, the abilities, the capabilities, and the interests of folks that are there and available to you. And, you know, it works on so many different levels. People that are there want to help, and there's nothing worse than experiences that I've had, and Dan, I'm sure you've had them too, you too, Sam, and that's, you know, someone who's self-dispatched with a carload of medications and shows up and says, hey, I came to take care of patients, yet they have no way to do that, no infrastructure, no support, no place to do that. And in reality, they just become someone else for you to have to take care of. And if you can find a way to utilize what the capabilities they do have in such a way that you can put them to work, then you benefit those around them, but you also make those people feel very valuable and useful and productive.
Yeah.
Right. And we don't want them to become a liability that one of us is going to have to take on. And I've seen that in so many after action reports, which we're studying right now, is God bless these people for wanting to help. But if they're not, and we mentioned this more than once, Joe, you know, if you're not a part of an organized team, you really shouldn't be responding to a disaster.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's true. You know, we had, when we were in Haiti, we had a hospital, the King's Hospital, that we got up and running. And we had two operating rooms and three orthopedic surgeons. And like we were there maybe 3 or 4 days, and came up and they said, hey, can we help? You know, we're orthopedic surgeons. We got 4 guys and we've got some nurse anesthetists. And I said, you know, we don't have any space for you. I'm sorry, we don't have any space. And then they said, so where are you guys staying? I said, oh, you don't have a place to stay. I said, no. We said, well, we got a house, you know, a couple miles from here that we're staying in with some people that worked out ahead of time, actually before we got there. And they said, oh, really? So where do you get your water? I said, oh, you don't have water. And how about food? Where do you guys get food? I said, oh, we brought food. We brought enough to be self-sufficient for 2 weeks. We brought our own water filtration equipment. I mean, we ended up finding water, but, you know, we had our own food. So here they were, no food, no water, no place to work, and they just become more victims that need food and water and shelter. So it's a tough situation. I had a guy in... after Katrina, that came up to me. I had this patient that came in complaining of belly pain. Now, you got to picture this scene. We have three tents that are tattered and beat up, and I have no idea where they came. Somebody just donated and brought them, and we set them up. So this guy comes in, kind of a heavy-set dude, and he's complaining of belly pain, and he hands me this piece of paper, and it's a prescription. And the prescription has his name across the top, and it says, this patient has a 5 centimeter abdominal aneurysm.
Oh.
You know, it's just not the piece of paper you ever want to be handed.
No.
So, and there was as many as 6 helicopters at a time landing all around us, blowing our stuff all the time, noisier than heck. And I had this great relationship with the guy that was air traffic control. You know, he had this big, huge suitcase on his back with this big whip antenna coming out. It was cool. I wanted his radio. That was the thing. But so I just go over to him, and I tap him on the shoulder, and I said, hey, I need the next helicopter. This guy's got an aneurysm, and he's got belly pain. He needs to get out of here. And this gentleman comes up, and he's wearing all khaki. So he looked really official. And he said, where are you going to take him? And I said, we're going to take him, fly him over to Oxnard. And he said, well, the military helicopters cannot take him to the civilian hospitals. And I'm thinking, oh, great. You know, I mean, things change. We've been doing it for 3 days, but apparently somebody had changed the rules because this guy looked official. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm running through in my head, how are we going to get this guy there? What roads can they go on? And can they get there in time? And I'm problem solving. I said, you know, my name's Dan Diamond. I haven't met you. And he said, well, my name's, you know, whatever. And I said, well, so what do you do? And he said, well, I just came to help. I said, well, what's your official position? He said, oh, I don't have one. I just came to help. I said,
no.
I mean, you just showed up here. You're wearing all khakis. You look like you're some kind of military guy, but you're not. And he says, no, I just came to help. I said, get out of here. You're taking away my resources. And he said, well, those helicopters are too heavy to land on these civilian hospitals. I said, no, they're not. These guys can land helicopters on eggs.
You know, and when did you become the authority?
Yeah, these are some of the best helicopter pilots in the world. And you're going to take away my resources right when I need them the most? Go away.
Oh, my God.
That was horrible. I'm sure I hurt his feelings.
Of course you did.
Yeah, what if you had sent this guy by ground based on that information and the guy died on the way in?
That guy's feelings needed to be hurt.
Thank you.
But yeah.
They really did. I try to be nice to everybody. You know, I know his intentions were good. He was just in the wrong place.
Well, and he was giving bad information that he didn't have any privy to.
Yeah.
I mean, well, and making it look and sound official.
He knew just enough to be dangerous. I mean, is it true that most military helicopters cannot land on rooftop helipads? Sure it is, but that doesn't mean those guys can't just hover right there and drop the patient off.
You know,
I mean, they don't have to land at all. I mean, you don't know what you're talking about as far as the actual patient delivery component of that is concerned. So.
And there's variables between helicopters and rooftops and personnel. And
you can't park that helicopter on the rooftop of the
hospital. There you go. Yeah.
But you can certainly discharge a patient from the hospital.
Well, we did it many, many, many times.
Right, yeah. And so they will find a way to make it happen.
But there was, I would guess that I spent 20% of my time in Katrina, telling people, we don't need you.
Yeah, me too, Dan. 20%. We ran into a lot of folks like that.
It was, you know, I mean, I had work to do, and they were taking me from the work that we had, that I had to do to say, thanks anyway, appreciate it. And I know you guys got great intentions, but we're covered here. You need to go back to Lafayette, check in at command and see if they can assign you to a place. But we don't have anything for you here. And it's you know, I don't want to discourage people, but I'm the same, you know, for people that are listening, know that you got to go as part of an organization.
And yeah, we've
actually talked about that quite a bit
and
before.
And we do, and we need to talk about it some more because it's going to happen again.
Yeah.
But there are organizations that you can become a member of. There are non-governmental organizations, there are governmental organizations, depending on where you are and what your expertise is. There are ways for you to give back or be prepared to give back. You just have to do a little bit of research and find that NGO or that governmental organization, that DMAT or USAR or whatever, and say, I want to join your organization. And they're usually glad to have you, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, but the time is not when the disaster is going on.
Exactly.
Right.
You got to do it. do it way ahead.
That's what I'm saying. If you're listening to this show and you like that kind of concept, now's the time to join
Medical
those
Teams
organizations.
International, before Medical Teams International will send somebody in on a first-in team, they require you to go on late-phase disaster response, and then they have a whole training program.
Awesome.
And their training program is fabulous. I mean, we did a whole day training on security. Man, it was cool. We did it down in Oregon, and we did it at a fire training area. It was a big one, you know, so they had all these burnt out buildings and all this stuff. And we got in there, and I learned some lessons the hard way there and got critiqued. And, you know, that's the best place to learn. It was really, they had it set up so good. So we're driving in our vans through this thing. When we pull in, there's all these people selling rice and chicken and all this stuff to us. And, you know, but that was our lunch. And in the training, that was our lunch. So we had to negotiate that stuff. We got to eat some of that, sit on the side of the road. But while we're sitting on the side of the road, these people are going through our vans and stealing them.
Oh, no.
It sounds very much like Nepal, actually. Where one of the teams decided their guys could eat locally and the other team ate MREs the whole time. You want to guess which team had diarrhea most of the 2 weeks they were there?
The MRE guys, those things will constipate the heck out of you.
Well, good point.
Well, that goes the other direction. Yeah.
They are very low residue, for sure. Yeah.
It binds you up for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But you don't get the runs.
True, well, but they did not then, get
point, Joe.
I tell you, the one that got me, and because I'm all in favor of letting other people learn from my mistakes. After we got done with lunch, we got back in our vans and we were driving through this big firefighting compound training area. And we got to some kind of burnt out buildings and there was a kid laying in the street. And he was about 10 years old with moulage on, you know, and he's got bones sticking out of his leg and stuff. And I'm thinking, I know this is a setup.
Mm-hmm.
Because we got two vans full of people. We got about 10 people in each van going through the training. And there's a kid laying out there. I'm thinking, all right, I'll get out. I'll take one person with me. I'll go look. So I go look at this kid, and he's pretty banged up. And so he's still conscious. And I'm thinking, well, we can take him with us. So we start loading him in the van. Because, I mean, first thing I did was check the area and make sure there weren't any IEDs or, you know, anything going on and looking around, keeping my situational awareness up because I know they're going to jump me or do something here. And so we get this kid, and as we start loading him in the van, then all these people started showing up, and pretty soon there's a mob, and they're saying that we hit the kid. And they're trying to blame us for hitting the kid. So then we closed the doors and drove off through this crowd with this kid in the car, go around the corner, we get stopped at gunpoint. They accuse us of harboring a terrorist, and we... Uh-huh. They open up the door, they find the kid, they take the kid out, and they shoot him. So, you know, we got in this situation because we didn't understand the politics of what was going on. These people were blaming us for the accident and demanding money from us, and the crowd was growing, and they were getting angry. And the bottom line was, you have your goal of where you're supposed to be. You know what your mission is. Don't stop along the way to take care of disasters, even if it's somebody dying alongside the road, because there's a very good chance that it'll go bad. You just need to drive right on by, which is so hard for those of us that train in the U.S. Of course, I stop at car accidents and help all the time when I see them. I always ask if there's anything I can do. But in the developing world, don't do it.
And they know that of us. They know that. So they know they've learned how to take advantage of that. Because none of us are going to leave a kid laying in the street with bones sticking out his leg.
I will.
Well, you will now. I was wondering was the that was the lesson here was you just got to drive on by.
Yeah.
Otherwise, all these other things can happen.
Because it may be fake. You know, you might be putting yourself in an ambush situation. And if it's not fake, they're going to blame you for the accident. And then you get into it just becomes, it can escalate. And it escalated really fast.
Well, and I could guess, Dan, that any time you stop for anything that you weren't intending to stop for, that alone can put you in a bad situation because you don't know who else is around or what their intentions are.
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, we eventually got, we drove a little bit further and part of the training, they pulled us over, kidnapped us, put hoods over our heads, put us in a box.
Oh my God.
And then you'd hear gunshots. So you didn't know who they just shot. And, you know, it was just, even though it was training, it was weird. It was intense.
That's going to freak people out. I don't know that I'd want to go that far.
Yeah.
I mean, and people are going to have paid PTSD from that training, for heaven's sake. Oh, my God.
It's not bad. But it was, you know, it was taught by some people that really knew what they were doing. And you know, we learned a lot about situational awareness and about what to do if you get in different situations. And
swap out the T in PTSD for training, and it still means the same thing, right?
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Oh my God, that's insane! But I clearly you remember those lessons well. And you'll
I do. And you know that's the caliber of training that Medical Teams International invests in their people. So if people are looking for a place to get involved, that's a great one. I think they're fabulous. I really enjoy working with them and appreciate the training that I've had from them.
Well, and getting back to what Jamie was saying, within my DMAT alone, there's probably 8 or 9 NGOs that go on frequent missions. They go to Haiti to do regular care for folks that don't have regular care, and they're always looking for people that can jump on those teams with them. So if you are a medical provider and that's something you want to do, throw something up on the website and let me know, and I could probably get some information for you. But that might be a little different than going out with an American trained team. There's just so many opportunities out there. And it's back to what you were saying, Dan. You get people that are there, but they don't have the right resources. They don't have food. They don't have water. They don't know where they're going to sleep at night. And now somebody else is going to have to be responsible for them. So you really got to think about it. And speaking of the Philippines, Dan, before you get away tonight, we've been bouncing all over the place with some really good stuff, but that's one thing you promised me is that we didn't get to that at the last podcast. And I want you to tell us about some of your experiences there because we hear a lot about Katrina and some of the stuff stateside or some of the biggest disasters elsewhere, but you were there at the Philippines. We want to hear about that.
Yeah, it was, you know, every disaster has its own personality. So I would say if I took Katrina down to one word, I would say that it was crazy. If I took Haiti down to one word, I would say it was devastating. It took me about 3 or 4 months to recover and stop crying. Mm-hmm. In the Philippines, I couldn't get it down to one word. I got it down to 2 words, though. It was tender mercy. It was a completely different experience than anything I've ever experienced in disasters in 30 years of doing this. I felt like I came home and I had been loved. It was the most amazing thing. People would line up on the street, and as we're driving through different areas, they would wave and shout, "Thank you for coming! Thank you for coming!" You don't see that everywhere else in the world. The Filipino people were very resourceful, very, very appreciative, and eager to help each other. You know, we saw people rebuilding each other's roofs and jumping in and helping people. And they were just so grateful for any help that we would give them at all. We ended up doing a lot of community clinics. So they call their small towns barangay. And we would get assigned. We worked with one of the main hospitals in Tacloban. And they had a fabulous system. It was really, really cool. Every morning we would get up. We stayed at this hospital in one of the empty rooms. We just slept on the concrete and there we had our mosquito nets and everything all set up. But they would feed us at the hospital and then they organized all the relief work. So they had a big map and they were trying to figure out all the barangays and they would make sure that we sent teams to all of them. And then they helped us with our transportation. So we would load up. All the supplies were centralized at the hospital. We would go in and pull the antibiotics and the other supplies that we needed, load up our truck, and then every day they would send us out to a different barangay, and we would work with the clinics, because every barangay has a a clinic. And I mean, they weren't all in good shape. I mean, some of them didn't have any roofs on them anymore. And sometimes we would work out of a house, but we would go with the local health officer. One of the best things to do, again, it goes back to this idea of, I want to make other people into heroes. I'm not interested in making myself into heroes. So I want to make the local health officer into a hero. And how can I do that? How can I lift their status up within their community to make them look good? Like, they're partially responsible for bringing us in. If you need more help, she's doing a great job. This is, we're so proud of the work that she's been doing. You know, as outside people coming in, we're so impressed with the work she's doing. And we're going to leave supplies with her that she can use, you know, that kind of stuff. But, wow, what an experience. Oh, it was beautiful.
I so love how you do that. You know, you're trying to give some of the locals credit and some of the people that don't always get credit. And we're so used to the egotists that want to take it all for themselves. And you're leaving something really good behind when you do that.
Yeah, if you come in with the attitude of, hey, the Americans are here now, so now you're going to, for the first time in your life, get some great health care, you will undo the work that these guys have been working to build their reputation in their communities for years, and you can leave a horrible impact. If you build them up, yeah, and say, this person is really doing a great job, it's a, you know, because they look at us as the outsiders, as these are like the best medical people in the world that are coming to help us. And if we say, your local health officer is amazing, we're so impressed. And when we see patients, we have the health officer see them right along with us.
I love that.
It just works better. They know the resources. They know the people. You know, and then we can talk about how good they are.
And it could so easily go the other way, like you said, because we have people coming, all right, we're here now. You know, we'll take care of all your needs. And then you're stuck with what you got. But, hey, we're here now.
One day we flew into one of the remote cities. So we flew in Barangay. We flew in by helicopter. And I've got video of it that I can give you a link and you can put it on the webpage. It was really cool. Whoa. It was like, you know, flying in, and because we were part of an organization and we had worked with you know, we didn't care if Medical Teams International gets the credit. That's the important thing. It's like, we want to make the rest of the people look good. So when all this stuff is set up, so they flew two helicopters in ahead of time, got all the people all organized, got the clinic all organized, told them what, you know, when it was going to happen. And then when we flew in, it was like being a rock star. We'd fly in. There were probably 1,000 people all gathered to see us come in and land. And then we landed, we set up in this school, and I think there was 4 or 5 of us that flew in together, and we were all working as providers. You know, and not all of us were docs, but we're all just set up at tables. And so, you know, it's like, hey, doc, what do you think about this? So we all worked together really well. We just ask each other bounce ideas off. But if you're doing stuff on your own, you miss the opportunity to do that kind of stuff. But man, oh man, it was so cool. You know, we were there, we worked our brains out for several hours, and then flew back out again. And hopefully left this opinion that the local people were great because they were the heroes. They brought us in to help, and they were doing a great job.
Joe, I think you had some thoughts you were trying to slip in there.
Well, it is related to exactly what Dan's talking about, and that's, you know, our experiences internationally with the search and rescue piece is if you're in a foreign country and, you know, you're providing those services, and, you know, we're finally getting access to somebody that's been trapped in a building for 2 days. It's just standard policy for us is that we bring the local guys back in there, and they're the ones that make the rescue, not us. We're just there in support of them, for exactly all the reasons that Dan's talking about. You know, it really is much more about the cultural impact of that and what it leaves behind in ownership of those folks and that society. You know, in reality, you're only going to save a few people, maybe a few hundred people, but the impact that you have on that society society is tremendous. If you always include them and make certain that those folks are the ones that are really getting the credit and are lauded by, you know, this outside power that's, you know, the best in medicine and the best in search and rescue and all that other sort of stuff, to say your folks are amazing and they're doing a great job, that has such tremendous impact over such a long period of time that probably more than any, you know, rescue that you do or any, maybe even any medical care that you do in the process.
Well, I'm 100% convinced of that.
I love that concept. That's a, I wish everybody that is on a disaster team could hear you say that and go in with that mindset.
Yeah.
I think that would make a world of difference.
I've come across people in disasters that have this attitude of, hey, we got it. We don't need your help. And no, you can't borrow any of our supplies.
Mm-hmm.
That is so short-sighted. Like, my attitude is, when I go in, if you need what I have and you're going to put it to good use, okay, no problem. And I don't, you don't have to put our name on it or our sign or give credit or anything. It's about doing the work and getting the work done.
Right.
And when people have that attitude of, I don't care who gets the credit, some amazing stuff can happen. If you have the attitude of, well, it's all about us, and you're trying to grab media attention, you know, that's just gross.
And we don't want them to think of us that way.
It's also a great leadership quality. And, you know, in general, I mean, it can be applied anywhere, you know, giving subordinates credit for the work, the hard work that they've done, and you know, giving the rest of the team credit is important. And, you know, it's good stuff, Dan. Where can folks find you? Because you do, I know you do a lot of work with different organizations, corporations, and things like that. And people may want to, you know, get some more of your knowledge, maybe bring it in to help them out. Where can they find you?
They can go to dandiamondmd.com. Got lots of information up on my website. I've got some videos. And when I get deployed, I always blog. So my blog's got some great stories in there.
Great. Well, I'll have a link to that in the show notes. And Dan, it's been great to have you back here on the show again. Well, hopefully we can get you back another time.
Thanks a bunch. Oh, one other thing I wanted to mention to you.
Go ahead.
I came across a really cool resource, and you can put a link to this. It's a video that I just came across, made by a company called Riot, R-Y-O-T,
yeah,
about their experience in Nepal. And they went in and filmed it using 7 GoPro cameras. So they're always filming in 360. And you can go in and get an immersive experience of looking around to see what it's like. It's the closest that I've seen, that I've watched, that I went, yes, that's what it was like to be in Haiti. Or that's what it's like to respond to a disaster. And you can look at that and kind of take a look around and think about, how would you behave if you were standing there? It's worth doing. And then I really appreciate these guys from Riot. They crank out videos that have a call to action. And you know, I look at disasters and think, okay, I can't go to all of them, but I can still pitch in and help. You know, so if there's opportunities out there for you to go, great. If there's not, then there's still ways that you can help rally resources for people that need help during the disasters, help raise money, help raise awareness, that kind of stuff. But these guys at Riot are doing a great job. It's worth taking a peek.
Yeah, it's ryot.org, and I'll actually have a link directly to that specific video in the show notes. Because it's pretty powerful, and you can actually, during segments of the video that plays on their site, if you can actually drag the video around and look behind you. It's pretty cool. So
awesome.
I'll urge you to check it out, and everybody can do that. And Dan, thanks for bringing that to our attention, because there's some amazing video over there. I'm going to be digging in more into that than just the single video I found that you pointed us to, but they've got tons of different projects.
Jamie
like
has
this.
A new toy. Oh,
yeah,
no.
Something else.
Yeah.
He's going to be setting up his GoPros tomorrow to do something. And Jamie, we're going to have him back at least 10 times to suck all these stories out of him, because we never get as far as we want to get. So, right. You know, he knows he's just setting himself up for the next one. So we'll see Dr. Dan again.
I'll deploy with you guys is what I want to do.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Then we'd have some stories to tell.
That's what we need to do.
Could happen.
You know, we talked a lot about training in this episode and some of the training stories, especially that training experience you had with security training and just the way it was so immersive kind of reminds me of the stuff you guys do, Joe, with Paragon, you know, that type of immersive, hands-on training with real people who've been through it before and give you that experience of what could happen.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, I was thinking exactly as I was listening to Dan and going, wow, that sounds absolutely awesome. So that immersive, stress immersion piece is absolutely important. That's why those lessons are so well learned when you do that, is that those are very impactful training situations.
And that's why you call it the experience, right, Joe? Because it truly is.
Exactly right.
It is that immersive experience.
The experience of the people, and it's the experience that you go through getting there, so that when you actually do get in that situation for real, you're prepared to do it and you're prepared to be productive in that situation and not lost or overwhelmed by the stress that you're experiencing.
Right. In fact, I just had a police training that talked about that. And it's kind of a desensitization where if you've gone through it and you felt the stress of it, but now you know it, then you're going to react appropriately when the time comes. And it's just going to be like our muscle memory when we're working as medical practitioners. It's kind of that same thing. So, but it's, you can't get it out of a book. This doesn't work.
You're exactly right. You sure can.
So, Joe, where can folks find you if they want to bring this kind of training in for them, you know, as far as getting this type of disaster preparedness training?
Well, Paragon is on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com, as well as Facebook under the same name. Our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU, and you can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast.
Excellent. Sam, how about you?
Well, the usual social media places under Sam Bradley, SamBradley11 on Twitter. And certainly the disasterpodcast.com, and maybe on the next disaster, who knows, with Dr. Dan and Dr. Joe.
That'd be fun.
If this one doesn't, can you imagine the blogs we could create?
That would be amazing. And I
would just love to learn from you, Dan, all the things I can learn from you, which I think we're just cutting, you know, the very edge of what you can tell us. So I'm looking forward to more. And Jamie, if this one doesn't inspire people writing in and asking questions, I don't know what would, because we talked about some awesome concepts tonight that I hope a lot of people get to listen to.
Definitely. And so I urge people to come and find us over at disasterpodcast.com. Ask Dr. Dan a question and we'll send him the link and he can go over there and leave a response on the site. And, you know, if you've got something that you want to learn more about or you want us to cover in another episode, you want something you heard Dr. Dan talk about that you wanted to expand upon in the next episode we have him on, go ahead and leave a comment over at disasterpodcast.com and we will get back to you. We always read those comments and we check back in and leave a comment back, usually several comments back. So please do that. But just a great episode, Dan. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks a bunch. I really appreciate it.
And Sam, you know, Dan just teaches us again that, you know, that austere medicine in disaster situations is just something new and different.
And we're always learning something new about it as we have different guests on. So, yeah, absolutely. Disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.